Okay. So I'm going to talk about something very strange. Very strange. You'll never hear about this in university. And if I hadn't read Modesta's essay on the subject, I would never have dreamt of it myself. There are really two parts. I'm going to start with the part which I think is the one I want you to get. If you get that, I'll go to the other part too. It depends on how much time we have. But this is the part I really want you to get. Modesta says, you're a person who has to make decisions what to do, how to live. To make a decision, you take a look at the world around you and try to figure out what's going on. And the way you figure out what's going on the basis of what you figure out, then you decide what to do. If you see that elementary school teachers are paid very little and they're generally despised, so you're unlikely to want to become an elementary school teacher. You see that engineers are making a lot of money and have a lot of respect, so you're probably more attracted to engineering. You take a look around and figure out what's going on, what the facts are, and then, on that basis, you decide what to do. Now, when you take a look around and decide what the facts are, you decide what the truth is, you have to analyze. You have to analyze, you have to evaluate, you have to weigh up evidence for and against. Not simple, especially since when you make some decisions, you'll have to take a stand on things that are pretty controversial. You'll say one thing, somebody else will say, no, that's crazy, you know, the truth is the other side. So, you go and look for information, you compare notes with other people, you ask them about their experiences, but at a certain point you have to weigh it up and come to a decision. Now, this weighing it up, the bottom line evaluation, that's an act of judgment. You're using your judgment to figure out what to accept and which way to go. One big failure of judgment is when a person is not objective. If a person is not objective, you can give him all the facts. It doesn't matter. Because when he comes to weigh up the facts, when he comes to evaluate, when he comes to interpret the facts, because he's not objective, he twists things, rationalizes things, and comes out with the wrong decision. We all know this because we know other people who aren't objective. And we point it out to them. It should occur to us once a year or so that maybe we're also not perfectly objective. We're very quick to spot the fallacies in other people's thinking. And we can point out why. But we ought to recognize that if other people make these mistakes, maybe we do make these mistakes. And of course, if your judgment is not objective, or I shouldn't say is or is not, everybody's judgment has some weaknesses, and some people have more than others. To whatever extent your judgment is not objective, to that extent, you really can't trust your decisions. You really can't trust your conclusions. So, how could we test? How could we test how objective we are? How could we identify where we're lacking objectivity? What could we do to improve? This is Modesta's question. Maybe this is too abstract. I'll give you a couple of examples. Someone told me not too long ago, seriously, he said, I have a friend who was in his automobile and he was wearing his seatbelt and he was in an accident. The automobile caught fire. And the seatbelt jammed, and because he couldn't get out, he was very badly burned. And he told me, from then on, I made up my mind never to wear a seatbelt. Well, I don't think I would hire him as my working logician. Any policy you choose is going to have some cases where it goes bad. There's no policy that's perfect. There's no strategy that's perfect. The question is, how often does it go bad? That would be like a quarterback saying, the last time I threw a pass, it got intercepted, so I'm not throwing passes anymore. You say, listen, every policy has losses. Throwing passes means sometimes they'll be intercepted. But what's your percentage? 3% interceptions and 90% and 40% non-completes and 57% completes? That's terrific. Keep passing. But what? This guy, for whatever reason, he's traumatized. He has this picture in his mind of a burning car he can't get out, and that picture has hypnotized him. So he's filled with fear, and he's not rational. He's just not thinking objectively. Smokers, I have met smokers who, most people are smarter than that nowadays, but I have met smokers who told me, all this business about getting sick is baloney, it's the communists who are trying to weed out the great tobacco companies who are great capitalists, and they make up this crazy story. Why? Because they're smoking, and they don't want to face the battle of having to stop. So, we're all aware that people can lack objectivity. It would be worthwhile, so it's to try to figure out what causes us to lack objectivity, and then we could try, and then we could try to work on it. Try to reduce those things that threaten our objectivity. Now here comes Rav Dessler's Kiddush. Rav Dessler says, every moral failing, every moral vice, every bad habit carries with it a failure of thinking. If you have bad mitos, bad character traits, if you have bad habits, if you have bad values, that is going to cause you to think badly, to think poorly, to lack objectivity in your thinking. And therefore, a person who has bad habits, bad values, bad priorities, you should be suspicious that his thinking is not straight. And I said, this is shocking. What has the guy's morals got to do with his thinking? The guy can be brilliant and be a nasty guy. According to Rav Dessler, you have to be suspicious. Let's take some examples and see how vices, bad habits, bad morals, bad values create bad thinking. Illogical thinking usually because of a lack of objectivity. Let's take laziness. Laziness, I hate to say this to you guys because it might be too challenging, but laziness is a vice. It's bad. It's bad to be lazy. See, that's a big There are things that need to be done. And if you're lazy, you're going to be filled with regrets later. Why didn't I do something? Good. Now, what has laziness got to do with thinking objectives? I'll tell you. Some questions need a lot of thought. They might, and this is very daring, they might even require you to read something. That's going way out on a limb. John has to read something. But even the thinking, I don't just mean, drinking a few beers and shooting the bull passing the time by talking about politics. I mean thinking. Is it right? Isn't it right? How does it work? If that's right, then that's right. If that's right, then that's wrong. And how does it all fit together? That's work. A lazy person just won't put in the work. So what does he do? He looks at only part of the information, and he doesn't think carefully about it, he doesn't discuss it and debate it, and doesn't evaluate it carefully, and therefore he comes out with a half-baked idea, which just isn't true. It isn't true, and he bases his whole thinking on that. The laziness is causing him to have a wrong idea, Because one of the ways that you help yourself get better ideas is to have the energy and the commitment to investigate it as far as you're able to investigate. I'll give you another example. Let's just get some examples on the table so you see how the idea works. Let's take selfishness and pride. These two work together in the case that I'm going to describe. Selfishness and pride. Now, I'm going to tell you an idea, but you've got to listen carefully. Otherwise, you can run to foreign fields. One thing that helps you be objective is to take everyone's point of view with equal seriousness. Take everyone's point of view with equal seriousness. Everyone's point of view has to be given an equal hearing. Otherwise, I'm locked up inside my own ideas. How do I know that what seems right to me is only because I have my little slice of life, my little set of experiences, my particular cast of mind, and I'm not taking into account rafts and rafts of other information, and other considerations, and other experience. So, in order to be objective, you have to give everybody's point of view an equal hearing. Now, that does not mean the truth is decided by majority vote. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that in the end, everybody's view is equally valid. It just means that everybody's view has to get an equal hearing. One of the things you might do with a hearing is to say, this point of view is disqualified. But you have to give it a hearing. And then, if you disqualify somebody's point of view because it has some kind of demerit, you have to be careful that if you have that demerit, you disqualify yourself also. It's got to be applied equally across the board. So, we're all at a party, and all 21 of you are drunk. I'm the only sober one there. And the 21 of you swear on a stack of Bibles that pink elephants are marching in the door. No, it's 21 to 1. Must I knuckle under because I'm giving everybody's point of view an equal hearing? No! I heard you! But you're drunk. So after hearing you, I don't have to listen. But it follows that if I'm drunk, I have to disqualify myself also. And also my friends. And also the other people I usually trust. If drunkenness disqualifies, it disqualifies across the board. So everybody's point of view has to get an equal hearing. And then if you use reasons to accept or reject, those reasons have to be used fairly across the board. That's what it means to break out of your subjectivity, seeing everything from only your point of view, and try to see it from as wide a perspective as possible by listening to what other people have to say. Of course, some Australian Aborigine tries to tell me what he thinks about the stock market or surgery or why the sun shines, so on and so on. I say, listen, you know, when you get out of sixth grade, then we'll talk. You haven't got any education, so why must I listen to you? You're just not qualified to have an opinion on these subjects. But then, education has to be applied equally across the board to everybody. Okay, now let's go back. Selfish and pride. Selfishness and pride. A person who's either selfish or proud wants credit. He wants credit for himself. It burns him when other people get credit. Either because he's selfish and he can't stand to see anybody else get credit and recognition, or it hurts his pride. I have to be better than everybody else. What do you mean you have an idea different from mine? It's got to be wrong. And therefore, he's not listening. He's not listening to what other people have to say. And insofar as he's not listening to what other people have to say, he doesn't have the benefit of their points of view, and he's not going to be as objective as he could be. Because one of the things that makes you more objective is to listen to as many different points of view as you can. Not again to take the decision on the basis of a vote, but to listen. So selfishness and pride, like laziness, are moral vices, and they imply that a person's thinking is going to be less than perfectly objective. It's going to have a failure of objectivity in that respect. Another example. Here a jester takes an idea from the Maharal. A very interesting idea. We have rules for how a court should operate. Now, that's a court where you have a person with a complaint against somebody else, and there's a trial, and there are witnesses, and so forth and so on. But as the Maharal says, every time you're making up your mind about a subject, there's a courtroom going on in your mind. You're hearing claims this way, and you're hearing claims that way, and you're evaluating them, and making, trying to make a judgment. The rules of courtroom procedure could be applied to the discussions going on inside your own mind, and they will help you be objective. Now, here's a rule from our courtroom procedure. And then he explains how it applies to your inside your own mind as well. Let's suppose that Reuven claims that Shimon owes him money. So the Bezdin says, the hearing will be Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, Reuven walks in. Shimon calls on his cell phone, I'm stuck in a traffic jam, I'll be there at 3:25. Good? But look, Reuven is the one calling the action. He has the claim. And the one who has the claim speaks first. And of course, only one person can speak at a time, right? So, suppose the president says, look, why don't you speak until he gets here, you know? And if you finish, then when he comes in, he'll say, yes, then why should we waste 25 minutes? You're not allowed to do that. A judge or a bezdin has to have both parties present when either party is speaking. So you say, why? When Reuven is presenting his case, Shimon can't talk. He's not allowed to talk. He's not allowed to interrupt. Just has to sit there. So why not let Reuven talk before Shimon gets there? So this is what the Maharal says. You're a judge. And you have Reuven standing there telling you a story. Shimon borrowed money from me and he cheated me and he lied and he swindled me, you know. You're a judge. You're naturally sensitive person, and this person is telling you a tale of woe, a tale of injustice that he suffered from Shimon. You are likely to identify with him. You're likely to sympathize with him. Ah, but suppose Shimon is sitting there in the courtroom. Shimon's being there, his presence, his face is a reminder that everything Reuven says, Shimon has an answer. So don't go along with Reuven. Don't be taken in by Reuven. Because you know, in 10 minutes, Shimon is going to talk and he's going to say, it's a lie, he made it up, he cheated me before. So Shimon's being there prevents the judge from being taken in. That's why Reuven cannot talk until Shimon comes. Now, what's the application to our case? Let's suppose you're reading up on a certain subject, but which you have to make a decision. You've got the stuff in the library. It's going to take you 3 or 4 days to read up the material. A friend of yours knows that you're working on this. At the end of day one, he calls you up and he says, I understand you're working on X, trying to figure out what's right, what's wrong. Yes. He says, how's it going? How does it look so far? How does it look so far? With what you've seen so far? Now here there's a great trap. The great trap is to say, well, so far, it seems like it's right. Of course, I haven't seen 2/3 of the material. That's coming tomorrow and the next day. But in the meantime, so far it seems that it's right. Which means I'm already drawing a conclusion without seeing the rest of the material. That's a big mistake. That's a big mistake. What you ought to do is read all the material, put your mind on hold, and say, listen, I'm not making any conclusions. I'm not making any evaluations. Let's just see what it is. Because if you let yourself be dragged in, if you let yourself make what we should call a premature conclusion, then from then on,
a certain part of you wants to defend that conclusion. Otherwise, to change it means that you made a mistake. And it's not always the easiest thing to admit you made a mistake. So you're stuck with it and you're defending it. Then when new information comes up against it, you're already thinking up, oh, but it isn't really true and I can get out of it this way. Instead of letting the information come in without a judgment, a prejudgment, so that you can see it all in front of you and then start to evaluate. So just like in the courtroom, you put the other guy there and make sure you have the information coming in, and when you hear one, you shouldn't jump to the conclusion that the one is true. Here also, you have to hold back your judgment. You have to hold back your judgment. Self-control, self-restraint, patience, certain virtues, which enable you to arrive at a more objective conclusion. The bottom line is, any vice, any moral failing is going to carry with it a weakness in one's thinking. The last example I'll give you, and I'll stop taking questions for a moment because several people wanted to ask, is addiction to a pleasure. If a person is addicted to any pleasure, it can be, gosh, dare I mention it, smoking, or, smoking, what he wants to know, or drinking, or, or, God forbid, violence, or, video games, or overeating, food, whatever it is.
Learning.
Could be learning. Mm-hmm. Could also be learning. It's a subtle business I'm not going to go into tonight because it's not my very main subject, but he's right. There can be unhealthy learning as well. Anybody who's addicted to a pleasure of that kind, or any kind, is going to be prejudiced when it comes to thinking about that pleasure, whether it's good for him or whether it's good for other people. Not only does he destroy himself, but he encourages other people to do it because it's so good. If it's good for me, it's got to be good for others. And misery loves company. If I'm in pain, it's great. If other people be in pain, we'll all be in pain together. I mean, it becomes sick. And then the person can't think objectively about this subject. He can't see its failures. He can't see its bad consequences. And he can't be objective. So, as I said, the bottom line is any moral failing carries with it a failure of thinking. Questions?
I was going to ask, we had this idea that the evil inclination can be used and can be focused and channeled toward the good. And we don't have that with devices and clear thinking.
Well, you don't have it with devices. There are certain capacities which can be used for good or for ill. If you use it for good, then it's not going to be a vice anymore. The word vice means the capacity used for ill. That's what it means.
That's
not the right way to put it, yeah.
Let's say you're taking an argument to decide whether something, what you should do on a particular subject. So you said that you should take in everybody's opinion equally before making your decision.
Hear everyone equally. That's right.
But what if someone historically gives bad opinions? Should you just drop him out of the case? Like?
Probably. Or you know he's prejudiced, like anti-Semites. So then, of course, you shouldn't consider it. You gave him a hearing, but you took him and his character and his background and his record, track record into account. I said, listen, I gave you a hearing, but giving you a hearing, I have a good reason not to take your position into account. As I have told you so many times, if you have 5 billion people with one reason, it counts for one. And if you have one person with two reasons, it counts for two. You don't count people, you count reasons. So give everybody a hearing. But one of the things you want to hear is reasons. And if you don't get any reasons, then of course it's a judgment. Of course you're making a judgment. It is impossible to avoid making judgments except by committing suicide. You know what? I've said this over and over again, that we ought to make it pretty. Some of you guys with the computers could do this and put it up on the board over here. If you open your mind too much, your brains fall out. That's a person He's so open-minded, he doesn't make any judgments, which means he can't tell good from bad, he can't tell right from wrong, he can't tell productive from unproductive, smart from stupid, because his brains have fallen out. Of course you're making judgments. The point of my shiur tonight is how to make better judgments, not how to stop making judgments. Stop making judgments is inhuman. No human being can live without making judgments. So how to make better judgments? One way to make better judgments is to give everybody an equal hearing. But then, of course, you have to decide what to do with the things that you hear. Yeah.
How far can you take into consideration the evidence that you haven't come to? The evidence that isn't presented to you or is unavailable to you or inaccessible for whatever reason?
That's a difficult, difficult, tricky question. All you can do, and you can't always do this, but all you can do is say, look, if you know beforehand how much you need, and you know you haven't got it, then you just take what you've got with much less confidence. For example, they do surveys that are supposed to work, and sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. Let's say voter samples to tell which way an election's going. We're getting a lot of those now. Now, suppose you're the company that does these samples, and you have a report due tomorrow, and you've written out the statistics, and you need 5,432 samples split over the whole country, and right, and something, the hitch with the emails, whatever it is, you end up with 3,600. And you're supposed to have 5,432. So they divide up, all right. You can set percentages and everything, but you've only got about 60% of the number that you should. So then you say, well, okay, it's much less likely. I better leave a much bigger margin of error because I have less information than I really need. So if I know how much information I need, I know that I don't have it, then I can take what I've got and be much more cautious with it and expect worse results. But it happens over and over again. When you think you have all the information, according to your equations, you have all the information you need. And you didn't realize there was another factor that was relevant, and you get mishmash.
Yeah. Be aware of the courtrooms of your mind.
Yes. Be aware, and beware of weaknesses of courtrooms in general, and then try to improve. Nobody's going to be perfect, but try to improve.
Improve the defense or the offense?
Both. You have to improve both. So in your mind, both sides are fighting with one another. You don't know who's going to win. You don't know who should win. So you've got to do your best to make both of them as objective as possible. Now, Rav Gatz's principle has a very awful consequence. If moral vices threaten the objectivity of your feeling, of your thinking, then only good people can be trusted to give objective judgments. The better a person is morally, the more trustworthy is his judgment. I didn't ever see anybody take as scientists' experiments or speculations or papers or whatever and judge them on the basis of how good a person he is. Or anybody else's, a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, it just doesn't seem to come up. I think this is a blind spot. It's a blind spot that we have developed that morals have nothing to do with your brains and your judgment. What Rav Dessler is showing you is that it isn't true. It isn't true. You with me so far? Okay, now I want to explain to you why, if you'll ever tell this to somebody. For some people, you'll get an objection, which will be expressed with the greatest of contempt and irony and sarcasm. We have a community, they'll tell you. We have a community that is immune to this problem. Maybe this is a problem for certain people, certain types of groups, but we have a community that is immune to this problem. And that is the scientific community. Because, you see, there are tens of thousands of scientists, all working in the same area, all over the world. And it is impossible that they should all have the same problem, that they should all have the same prejudice, that they should all have the same weakness. Yes, there are lazy scientists, and there are also energetic scientists. Yes, there are prideful scientists. And then there are also, well, that's what they'll tell you. There are also humble scientists. I don't know if you can really find many, but you know, that's what they'll tell you. There are selfish scientists and there are generous scientists. There are scientists who are addicted to ice cream sodas, and there are scientists who are not addicted to ice cream sodas. There are scientists who are addicted to aqualung diving, and there are scientists who are not addicted to that. Now, let's suppose tens of thousands of scientists all over the world come to a single conclusion. That single conclusion is not based on laziness, because a lot of those scientists aren't lazy. And that single conclusion is not based on pride, because a lot of them aren't proud. And that single conclusion isn't based on a passionate drive for ice cream sodas, because a lot of scientists don't care about ice cream sodas. Since there are so many of them, and some are rich and some are poor, and some are in capitalist countries, and some are communist countries, and some are socialist countries, and some have a parliamentary democracy, and some have a representative democracy, and some don't have any democracy at all, and they all come to the same conclusion, so then the conclusion that they're coming to can't be the result of these kinds of vices or prejudices, because whatever vice or prejudice you pick, it cancels out. That's what they will tell you. So, maybe locally, or maybe with respect to individuals, or other types of groups, maybe you do have that problem, but not with science. And therefore, science will be very objective. Doesn't mean it's always right, but it means it'll be very objective. Well, you could probably tell from my tone of voice that I don't agree. Let me point out some ways in which the scientific community across the board shares universally certain prejudices and certain vices. There was a fellow at Yale in the 60s. His name will come back to me. Who did the following experiment. Let's imagine you're a graduate student at Yale, and you see an advertisement on the bulletin board for a psychology experiment. This is what they do with universities. They pay you $2 an hour. Oh, today it's $5 an hour. And it's just 60. It's $2 an hour. To do something in an experiment. Usually it's not too demanding. It's sometimes it's interesting to learn what they're experimenting about. So you come in, volunteering for $2 an hour, and they tell you this is a learning experiment. We teach people certain material, and then we test them on it. And what we are really investigating is negative reinforcement, negative feedback. And here's how we do it. They lead you into a room, smallish room, with certain dials and controls. And there's a glass panel looking into another room. And in the other room, there's a guy sitting in a chair, and you see that his ankles and his wrists are attached to the chair. There are electrodes attached to his ankles and to his wrists and to other parts of his body. And there's the guy in there with him, with the white coat and the clipboard, reading to him, asking him questions. And the other fellow sitting in the control room with you has the earphones on, he has his clipboard, he's checking things. He says, listen, we're asking him questions about the material that he learned. When he makes a mistake, we punish him. We punish him by giving him an electric shock. All you need to do, your job for $2 an hour, is to sit by the control board. We will tell you what level shock he's supposed to get, and you just turn the dial to give him the shock. I mean, for $2 an hour, you didn't expect, to build the Brooklyn Bridge. That's what we need. Fine, so you sit down at the dial. And, going along, you made another mistake, 40 volts. 40 volts? Fine. Two in a row, look at the 80 volts, give him 80 volts, right? So you turn up to 80. Well, it goes up and up, the guy keeps making mistakes. As it gets higher, you begin to see a little bit of response by the guy sitting in the chair, goes, ouch. Nebraska. Wrong again! Give him 120. Wow! And it goes up and up, and each time he gets higher, the results from the guy in the chair get stronger and stronger. So after a while, he's crying, and he starts screaming, and he starts begging for mercy, and the guy in the white coat says, ah, they always do that, 360! And the dial is marked mild, moderate, strong, dangerous, and fatal. Six in a row, 480! 480, and he screams and thrashes around. That's how it goes, right? Now, the truth is, it's not a learning experiment. There's no electricity. The guy sitting in the chair is an actor. The only subject in this experiment is you. How far will you go? How far will you go? The guy tells you to turn the dial. How far will you go? Turns out that young, brilliant, red-blooded American Yale graduate students will go as far as they're told. They'll go as far as they're told. Milgram. The guy's name was Milgram. That's the famous Milgram experiment. Stand one. 1 second. Now, the truth is that afterwards, these students who were tested, the ones turning the dial, some of them had nightmares afterwards. I mean, there was a real struggle going on here. They had psychological scars. And from this, the American Psychological Association made rules. You can't do experiments where the subject doesn't know what the experiment's about. But he wrote his paper. Milgram wrote his paper. Now, here's what he said in his paper. He said, I'm testing how people respond to authority. Do people continue to exercise their own judgment and their own evaluation, or do they give over their judgment and evaluation to authority? Here he's using science as an example of authority. And he says, I saw that people who you would have guessed would be the least likely. And this is supposed to have repercussions with respect to the Nazis, you know. The least likely to do this did it with very little resistance. Okay, Uncle Stanley, who wrote the paper and became famous thereby, I think made just one little error. He only tested one form of authority. Science. Science. He didn't test it with conductors on the train. He didn't test it with city mayors. He didn't test it with orchestra conductors. He tested it only with scientists. A more cautious and accurate conclusion would have been the authority of science leads people to give up their judgment and their evaluation. And that is surely true. Science has become almost a god. And it becomes laughable. When I was teaching at Hopkins, one of the guys in the physics department who discovered a particle, which is what you do to become big in physics, discover a particle. There's enough to go around. They think the problem is infinity of them. The student newspaper interviewed him for his views on religion. They printed an article. Someone clipped out the article and put it up on the philosophy bulletin board with the legend, see how many mistakes you can find in this. It was childish. It was childish. But of course, because he's a physicist, he's not a philosopher. What do you expect from the poor fellow? And the student newspaper, for reasons unfathomable to any rational mind, thought saw fit to interview this physicist about what he thinks about religion. Unless they were trying to make fun of him. Maybe that's his goal, I don't know. But that's where it is. If a guy's a physicist, he's an expert on everything, because he's got to be super bright and super rational and got to know the best about everything that there is. It's ridiculous. Now, that kind of position, that kind of authority, gives people so much power, gives scientists so much power, they have a lot to protect. They have a lot to protect. And that sets a community-wide prejudice. For example, there's a considerable amount of outright cheating and lying that goes on in science. And there's a very considerable effort to cover it up so the public shouldn't find out. Because it'll threaten their position. It'll threaten their authority. It'll threaten their governmental monies. Sorry? Right. From time to time, investigative reporters take their lives in their hands and they report on phony experiments. There was a guy exposed in South Africa 2 years ago. I think what field he was in. And he falsified results, which had implications for pregnant women. It was something unbelievably horrible. Drugs, certain use of drugs, which were dangerous.
Only
and that's I agree. Only South Africa. We only have South Africa. So that's number one. Number two, science is built, I'm putting this in the most charitable way possible. You could make it more nasty, but I'm trying to be charitable. Science is built on a method. The method is, you see something happen, look for a natural explanation. Natural means something physical, something operating according to laws that we can understand. Natural. Now, if you catch a person, dare I say a scientist, in a sober moment, if you can find one, and ask him, why are you limiting yourself to the natural? Why? Isn't that a limitation? You're sort of saying, look only here. Why should I look only there? Why shouldn't I look everywhere? Why should I close any doors before I have an explanation? You dare to ask that question, so they flunk you and throw you out. But if you don't happen to be in the class, so they have no power over you, and you nudge them long enough, an honest one will say, that's what we do. That's our job. Our job is to find natural explanations. We're not closing the door on anything else. We're just, that's what we're trained to do. We're trained to find these kinds of explanations. Maybe it won't be there, and maybe it really belongs someplace else, but that's not our job. That's honest. That's honest, and that's true. But, imagine what will happen if there are significant areas where there are no natural explanations. Then science is going to lose a lot of its prestige, lose a lot of its applicability, not to mention its government money. So there is tremendous pressure to provide natural explanations, even when the evidence doesn't really warrant it. This is the story of evolution. I'm not going to go through it now in detail. We'll talk about it someday. But evolution, from the beginning, has had tremendous barriers against it. And in spite of those barriers, many, many people, not all, there was considerable debate, but many, many people pledge allegiance in grossly premature fashion, long before there was enough evidence to accept it. Even today there isn't enough evidence, I would argue. Why? Because if you don't accept evolution, you have nothing. You have the whole of life with no explanation at all. That's a gigantic hole. If you can plug that hole, science becomes tremendously more powerful. And they have a tremendous interest in preserving that power. So instead of the first position, which I credited as honest, we're looking for natural explanations, and who knows if it's there, maybe it's someplace else, but that's our job. Our job is to look at the natural ones, which would then allow you to say, nope, this doesn't seem to work. The evidence is against it, so we really don't have everything. As against someone who says, it's got to be there. That's all that is. Not that it's all we're working on, but that's all there is. Because you see, if that's all there is, and we're working on it, then we have everything. And we're great. We're great. We're terrific. And that slips over the bounds. Indeed, one contemporary philosopher, who happens to be religious, not Jewish, said that a religious person who investigates a scientific subject is more objective. He's more objective than the atheistic scientist. Because the atheistic scientist has to find a natural solution, whether it's there or not, whether the evidence supports it or not. Whereas a religious scientist could say, look, if I find a natural solution, then I have found how God did it. And if I don't find a natural solution, I can say that God did it without doing it in a natural way. I'm open. I can see it either way. It hurts me in neither direction. So he's much more likely to be balanced and objective about what he sees than the atheistic scientist who has to see it that way. Yeah.
is the scientist being intellectually dishonest by saying it's only a theory and this is the best solution that we have?
Alibi, they would say it. I wish they would say it. Many of the greatest don't say that. Many of the greatest say, now we know. Now we know. I think it was the Baltimore Science Museum that I was in many years ago, and they had an exhibit on how the continents got to be the way they are. And they put in cartoon figures of thinkers in the past. Well, it was Descartes and Leibniz and, you know, famous thinkers in the past with their stupid ideas about how the continents got to be the way they are, with the cartoon balloons, you know. And the last panel is plate tectonics, which is, of course, the truth. It's the truth, which we discussed. So here's this exhibit. Look at how stupid people were up until now, and now we've got it. If I were designing that exhibit, I would have added one more panel. And I would have dated it 2010, and I would have put a big question mark. To give the observer a little perspective, this is what we say now. But it will be a decade from now. Maybe we'll have to reduce this panel to balloons. You know, that's what they thought then, those dumps. But now we know, right? But this is the way it's done. That's what they thought in the past. And this, you know, it's a little bit of a digression, but it's the same general idea. We are now in January 12th, 2003. Let's think back 100 years ago. 1903. Gosh, yeah. The Dark Ages, right? Think about what they taught in universities in 1903. They didn't know about relativity. They didn't know about quantum mechanics. Everybody thought Freud was God's right-hand man, if not God himself. They hadn't discovered molecules. They didn't know about DNA. How much of what was taught in universities in 1903 is being taught today in universities in 2003? A lot of it has been discarded. And a lot of it has been superseded. Right? Now I want you to perform just a little experiment. Think ahead to 2103. How much of what's taught at universities today is going to be taught 100 years from now? Or have we finally come to the truth, right? The final panel in the museum, science museum? No more revisions. The science museum will stay the same forever? Probably not, right?
We all live around the truth.
The majority of what is taught in universities today is false. Aside from mathematics, and in mathematics it becomes obsolete. It's not just, it doesn't become false, it just becomes obsolete. What about pecs and bushels and all the stuff that they used to have to learn in those days? You don't learn about that anymore because it's obsolete. We have different measures. We have different ways of doing mathematics. Oh, I don't think that's right at all. Plate tectonics is not an improvement on the old theory. The old theory is
everything.
Oh.
Everything is an improvement.
Well, a lot of it is not improvement. So when Jung and Adler and the feminist critique of Freud, that wasn't just fine-tuning Freud and sort of updating him a little bit. That was throwing him in a trash can. Margaret Mead and her whole sociology turns out to be 98% false. Half of it she made up, and half of it they liked her, and she accepted it. This is not just improving things. This is discovering gross errors. I don't think that's right. Give me 25 cases where it's not like that. I'm giving you cases where it is like that. Astronomy, right? I mean, what we used to think in 1903, what we know are galaxies, they thought were stars.
How about English in business, in medicine?
Yes, let's take medicine. Would you like a list? I know. I saw a review article of the medical literature of 1903, and the number of methodological mistakes and sloppy experimentation and poor logic leading to life-threatening procedures was legion. This isn't just fine-tuning medicine. Medicine made gross mistakes. In the 40s and 50s, they performed tens of thousands of lobotomies. They cut out part of your brain to stop seizures. They don't do that anymore because it was a mistake.
How do they do it?
So what? They stopped it before they had the pills because they realized there was a mistake. I used to x-ray my feet to check my shoe size. When I was a kid, you went into a store to buy shoes, you put the shoe in a fluoroscope and you looked down with an x-ray machine and you saw your bones of your feet in your shoes. We didn't fine-tune that to make better x-rays. We don't do it because it's dumb. My sister-in-law, birthmarks, which are strawberry-colored eruptions of skin, used to be burned off with radiation. That's what they did to kids. When she, 20 years later, they had to check whether they didn't burn out her thyroid gland. When I was a kid, as I told some of you, when they took out my tonsils, they took out the adenoids automatically. Because the adenoids certainly don't do anything. They're vestigial, so says the evolution. And since we haven't found anything, they must do nothing. And they could get infected. So while we're in there taking out your tonsils, we take out the adenoids also. Right? But it turns out that the adenoids play a role in the immune system. They just didn't know that. That's not fine-tuning. That's just a gross error. And margarine and butter. Margarine turns out to be as bad or worse for you than butter. After 30 years of selling to the plant oils because they're much better than animal oil, turns out not to be true. I mean, there's a long, long list. Charles Krauthammer had a long article on this, in one of the publications where he writes. So I think that you have to be very, very cautious and skeptical here. You're very fortunate. You're so young that you haven't lived through a number of these. When you get to my age and you've lived through a few dozen of them, you begin to feel that the whole industry has to be taken with gigantic grains of salt. Yeah.
For, isn't it cut off of the method of whatever, curing a disease or whatever, doing anything, whatever is normal in society, what is an accepted norm, that you should do that?
Absolutely. Of course not. Normal in a society? You know, there are societies that practice voodoo witchcraft. You know, they take a doll, they put a pin in, and that's supposed to cure you. Because it's normal by them, we should do it. Mop your toe.
If it's normal, that if you have a holiness season, and it really hurts, you have to have a filling. Yeah? Now, but should we say once every 10 years, maybe they're going to find that in 50 years, that the filling
may
cause you some disease or whatever.
The first thing is that the word maybe in this case is absolutely correct. Maybe they will discover it because they do discover things like that. Secondly, you have to ask yourself, given the evidence that I have, given the track record of this particular profession, given the self-criticism of the profession, to what extent should I trust what they're saying? And thirdly, you have to ask what my alternatives are. Right? If it's saying, as we usually say, if I know that I'm going to lose this way, and this might help, so then I take it as the best alternative available to me at the moment. But that doesn't mean I pledge allegiance to say it's correct. And I look also for other alternatives and see what can be done without it. In many, many cases, surgery. A friend of mine is a doctor, and he was working in a hospital. This was in the 70s, and they didn't have a bypass unit. You know, in heart surgery. So they petitioned the administration of the hospital. You can't run a modern hospital without a bypass unit. You know, patients will avoid us. They said, fine, we'll get you a bypass unit on one condition. We must have 5 bypass operations a week. No matter what. Because otherwise we can't pay for it. And he told me he was called in for a person who was suffering dizzy spells. And before he could get to the patient, they had him in the bypass unit. Because after all, if your heart isn't pumping blood right, won't you be dizzy? Surely you'll be dizzy if your heart isn't pumping blood. Give him a bypass. He said, I didn't even get a chance to examine him. So they estimated a decade ago that 20% of the bypasses done in the United States are unnecessary. So you have to wake up a little bit and the fact that the guy is an MD or PhD after his name doesn't mean that you should trust everything that he says. You have to be, ask him what are his interests. And when, you know, in ancient China, I read, you had a personal physician and the rule was you pay the doctor as long as you're healthy. When you get sick, you stop paying him. Our whole medical profession necessitates sick people. If everybody were healthy, they'd go out of business. Now, these are the people into whose hands you are putting your health. People who need you to be sick. Doesn't that create a conflict of interest? wouldn't any reasonably justified society say that a judge who has a personal benefit from the decision under his jurisdiction should disqualify himself? Here these people are making judgments about your life, and they have a monetary investment in your being sick.
Yeah, proof
of that. What are you talking about? If people were healthy, these people would be out of a job. What would they be doing?
You can say that about anything.
Correct! Correct! My father, Oliver Shulam, told me that there was a play that was put out about somebody who invented a process whereby suits will shed dirt and never get dirty. And the dry cleaners got together and killed him. Because it'll put the dry cleaners out of business. They need dirt. Things have to get dirty. So the only way you get around it to a certain extent is this. In medicine, if you're going to have an advance, right, which makes an old treatment obsolete, so then all the companies that produce the old treatment are going to go under, right? The only way you get around that is that the same company that's doing the old treatment has to develop the new treatment. So that they can shift from the old to the new and they don't go out of business. Otherwise, there will be no progress. There will be no progress. That's why every company is allowed to devote a certain amount of its money to R&D, to research and development. Because if you don't allow that, then they will not allow any new treatments to be, because they and their shareholders will go out of business. Wake up! This is a real world where hundreds of millions of dollars ride on these kinds of decisions. Yeah.
Was it in our lifetime that getting a second medical opinion became a common practice?
I don't know. I don't know when that became a practice. I'll tell you where it happens today. You go to a hospital, and you get treated in a hospital, and try to get your records because you're transferring to another hospital. And they make your life Gehenna. I know many people who have had to steal the records. Because, what do you mean? If you lose, they lost the case. They will hold people in hospital extra days because of empty beds. If empty beds, you're not being paid by the insurance. So the same person can on one occasion be held for 3 days and one occasion be held for 1 day. We have very close friends. The wife is a labor coach. And she has a principle, 12 hours, no more in the hospital. After she gave birth, every time she walked out of the 12 hours. But you're endangering and it's terrible and you know who's going to... You have to sign a release that you're taking your own responsibility. She said, either you give me the release or I'm walking out without it. I'm getting out of here. Ever heard of iatrogenic disease? That's disease caused by medical procedures. There are certain bacteria that live only in hospitals because there's so much antibiotics in hospitals, the bacteria become very resistant. At least that's what the evolution is like. That's because they have no room. Correct. And a new case gives them more money than holding on to an old case because the more for procedures, the first couple of days, the more sophisticated. But wait until they won't have room. By the way, the medical profession limits the number of doctors. They limit the number of doctors so that they'll always be in high demand. They make sure there's not overproduction of doctors. You're talking about big business here. They are in it to make money. Are there individuals who are kind-hearted and so forth and so on? Yes, there are. But the profession as a whole, just imagine you would find a grass that cures diabetes. It would be a disaster. There are hundreds of millions of diabetics. They're all shooting insulin. What are you going to do? Just sell them grass? Do you know how much money that I pay to my health company for my insulin? It's a gigantic amount of money every month. Right? These people will go out of business. They're not going to let something like that happen. Yeah.
This is quite Luke's point of service today, but I saw this statement made by the U.S. Patent Office in 1899. It's hindsight from the day it said, everything that can be invented already has been.
This is a good example. This is a good example. And I have it from Albert Michelson in 1903, from Max Born in 1928. People who said science is over, it's finished, there's nothing new to discover, it's all. Stephen Hawking, quoting these mistakes in the past in his introduction to A Brief History of Time, which was his inaugural lecture at Cambridge, wrote that within the next generation it'll be finished. it's this tremendous desire to finally have the truth. At any rate, the bottom line is that morals have a direct effect on the objectivity of your thinking. The more vices a person has, the less objective his thinking is. The more morally refined and developed a person is, the more objective his thinking is. And therefore, if you are looking for a balanced opinion, you need to consider the morals of the person or the community that is making the judgment. And especially if you need a balanced and objective judgment about the personal decision, when you're looking for advice, what you want is people who can, as I said, I don't talk about objective versus non-objective. It's not an absolute matter. It's a matter of degree. But the less vices the person or the group has, the more likely you are to get a more balanced and more objective opinion. Yeah. Okay, so I'm sorry, you're right. Now, I should have come back to that. That's where I started. What I started was that when you identify in yourself certain certain things that reduce your objectivity, and you want to be better, you want to make better judgments, then you should work yourself to try to overcome them. And any one of the ones that I mentioned, especially when you're going into a particular decision, a particular investigation, and you know you have this weakness, you should try to offset it and discount it somehow.
So what do you work with?
Look, I think it will vary very much in terms of what the problem is. If the problem is laziness, a chavrusa is a terrific antidote. Because he's not going to let you get away with anything. Yeah, okay, but we're talking about thinking about a problem now. Thinking through a problem. And if you're inclined to make premature judgments on the grounds that it's too hard for me to go through the whole thing, and you're discussing it with somebody, and you know that if you make a false move, he's likely to shoot you down, then your own self-interest will propel you to think it through more carefully, more clearly. So you can take measures like that to try to overcome. But each vice will have to be fought out in a different way. Yeah?
Yeah. Now we should only have prune doctors.
Well, I'll tell you something. It definitely helps to have run doctors. There's no question. And certainly psychologists, but even doctors. Or doctors, I'll tell you, I've had minor medical problems in my lifetime. When I was living in Baltimore, ended up being a kidney stone, and the doctor did x-rays and did some examination. I said to him, so what is it? He said, well, I'm not really sure. Given my experience, most likely it's this, but there are exceptions. I'm not really sure. I walked out of there with a feeling of confidence and security. Here's a doctor who tells me he's not really sure. This guy is leveling with me, so I can trust him. Compare that with what a gynecologist told my wife. He said to her, with her first birth, I don't think she used him in the end. He said, and of course you'll take anesthesia. Which anesthesia would you prefer? She said, I want it natural. I don't want anesthesia. He said, every one of my patients uses anesthesia. She said, why not? I mean, why? Why should you do that? I've read that it's better for the baby, certainly, not to have anesthesia. And he wouldn't, listen, it came out, finally. The reason why he required the patients to take anesthesia is because he couldn't stand the screaming. It just bothered him. So, you know, why have a bunch of screaming ladies, you know? I blame him. If I had known better, I'd have done malpractice on him at the time. But then, you imagine, he told her this. It's just too noisy and too nerve-wracking. We don't like it. You know, it's much calmer if the ladies aren't screaming.
Did you give her the answer?
Eventually, when she pressed him and pressed him and pressed him. There was another one. This is even worse. Listen to this. A good-hearted guy, didn't have any medical practice, but I'm telling you, I'll tell you a better story. My mother-in-law's sister was in the hospital in Florida. She had been in and out. She had various, fairly serious medical problems. And she was in a life-threatening situation. So the doctor said to my mother-in-law, we're going to try X. We'll try X for 3 days. If it works, fine. And if not, then that's it. So my mother-in-law said, what do you mean, that's it? Well, you know, if X doesn't work, then, you know, we'll just let her go. So my mother-in-law said, I'm not ready for that. And the doctor said, I don't need you to be ready for that. So my mother-in-law called me up in hysteria and said, he's telling me that if X doesn't work, he's going to let her die. He isn't going to try anything else. He's not going to do anything else because He doesn't need me. Are you ready for that? What do I do? I said, you call your rabbi, you call the newspapers, and you call the police. That's what you do. And you tell him that that's what you're doing. Now he said it. How many do it without saying it? We had a fellow living at our house who was doing an externship. He's now a very, very highly respected doctor in Baltimore. We were living in Baltimore at the time, and he came to South Africa. Anyway, he told me that interns who are there at night, when they hear the call on the intercom, Dr. Black means cardiac arrest, and you have to run and resuscitate the person. They have agreements. If the person's 34 and he has only one ailment, and this is an extraordinary occurrence, you go and resuscitate him. But if he's 72 and he has several ailments and he's not going to last more than a couple years anyway, you just let him go. You walk. You don't run. You walk. These are interns deciding who shall live and who shall die. So don't be too romantic about the medical profession. And then the last one, we had living in our building a fellow who's a pathologist, and his brother's a pathologist. His brother told the following stories. Pathologist at a hospital in New York, where the head of cardiac surgery is a big bulk guy, you know, a real overweening, proud person. And whenever there's surgery and somebody dies, so then they have to go and make an autopsy investigation, see what went wrong. And my friend's brother is the, he does the autopsies. So he does the postmortem. So there's this guy dies, and he does the postmortem, and the chief of cardiac surgery comes down with his residents and says, well, what happened? Why did he die? He said, well, the incision was perfect, and the cutting was perfect, and the sewing up was perfect, and all the blood work was perfect. But the heart pump that you put in was put in upside down.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. Every surgeon kills people. Every surgeon kills people. Because every surgeon makes mistakes. Surgeons are human. Surgeons are human like everybody else. And surgeons, oh, the number of stories that they left the scissors inside, and they left the scalpel inside, and they cut off the wrong leg, they cut off the wrong thing. My wife here in Shaare Tzedek Hospital was going here with her mother, and she had certain tests being done, she asked to look at her chart. And on the chart, it said, disease of the prostate gland. Women don't have a prostate gland. They just mixed it up, that's all. A good friend of mine's wife died. She died of cancer here in this city. And she had, at a certain time, she was taking medicine through a tube that was inserted into her body surgically. And every couple of months it had to be replaced. So they're wheeling her in to replace it, and she needs a number 11. And he sees that the surgeon has with him a number 12. She says to her, according to the reports, she's got to get an 11. Doesn't matter, says the surgeon. 11, 12 doesn't matter. He said, but the reports say 11. She's always had 11. It doesn't matter. Leave me alone. He said, but you have to be. I'm not letting you. He grabbed onto the bed. He said, I'm not letting you go in. There's an 11. There are no 11s in the hospital. He said, stay right here and don't move. He ran up to the department, got an 11, brought it down, and they put in an 11. He was giving her her medication. And the doctor told him what medication to give and the dosages. She was having a terrible reaction to it. So he read the Horaot, the instructions. Now it's five long pages in Hebrew, difficult Hebrew, and he's a bright fellow, but he read all the way to the end, and he saw at the end that the minun, the dosage that the doctor was giving, was different from the dosage that's written in the instructions. So he called up the doctor and said, you told her this and this dosage, and in the instructions is that and that dosage. What should I do? He said, oh, if that's what it says in the instructions, then that's what you should do. I myself, I had a terrible, terrible rash three times. We were living in Baltimore. The first time, it was beyond belief. So, and my regular doctor was on leave, so his stand-in gave me prednisone. Now, prednisone is a cortisone, which is a quite serious, quite strong medicine. I started taking it Friday afternoon. And it did help. I mean, it took off the edge and eventually went down. I kept taking it Saturday night. I didn't sleep the whole night. Now, listen, I sleep. it's not a problem. It's just, you know, for me, I just hit the bed. It's no problem. Right? So I waited till 7 a.m. Sunday morning. Wasn't that nice of me? And I called up this guy, the replacement. I said, listen, I was up the whole night. And he says, so? I said, well, you know, I usually sleep well. He says, so? So I said, well, could it be the medication? He said, no, it couldn't. I said, but then what could it be? He said, maybe you're nervous or upset about something. Now listen, I have a PhD. And the night before my oral exam for the PhD, I slept fine. I just sleep. That's the way I am, you know. Well, I found out later that in the gigantic book of medications, which every nurse has and knows, and my sister-in-law's a nurse, she showed it to me inside, it says right there that sleepiness is a side effect of prednisone. Any cortisone. But this guy didn't know and didn't care. So you have to be very, very careful. If God forbid, you or any of yours are in a hospital, you need to know, there has to be a family member who's there prepared to take responsibility for the person's case. Number one, if a family member is there, the whole medical staff is more careful because somebody's watching. And number two, because they're understaffed, because they're overworked, because they have a lot of responsibilities, they'll make mistakes, they mix up medications, they mix up times, they mix up patients, right? Whatever it is. And then there's my friend told me, and then I read about it. There is an unwritten war going on in hospitals between the doctors and the nurses. Each one thinks they know better than the other, and they will contradict each other's orders. The nurse says, the doctor comes in for 20 minutes a day, and we're here 24 hours a day. Who knows the patient better? Who knows what's bothering the patient better? They give this dosage, that dosage. We know better than that. We see the reaction to the medication. They don't see it. We know better to give it or not to give it, and so forth and so on. These are nurses contradicting doctors' orders out of sympathy, out of the goodness of their hearts. But they're nurses, and you're a patient, and you don't know what you're getting. Yeah.
There's a hospital in Brooklyn, a very famous hospital that most former people use, that they have an unwritten rule that if a person has a stroke, if the bleed is very big, they will not operate because there's a bigger chance for them to lose the patient and they'll look bad.
The same hospital. Suppose it's crazy.
Talking about the Maimonides.
Yes.
The worst hospital.
I know.
They have the best public relations agency.
Yeah, that's it. Listen, with a name like Maimonides, what could be bad?
I work with two politicians who represent that neighborhood, and they both get big money from the hospital.
Yeah, and I work for Plateau in that area.
Oh, you're from Marcella? Oh. My Rebbe's the Boston Rebbe, so
okay.
You know what that means. Yeah.
Did you guys miss the beginning of the hospital?
No, I answered that to him. I'll answer once more to make sure that it's clear. Let me give you an example. You have a difficult question. A question to which nobody you know knows the answer. Now, there are three pieces of paper. One of them has the right answer on it. The other two have wrong answers on it. You have a chance to pick one of the three pieces of paper and do what it says. Would you take it? Sure, because without the piece of paper, you're for sure going to get it wrong. Because you have no idea what to do. If you take a piece of paper, you got 1/3 chance of getting it right. So given your alternatives, it may be the best thing you can do is to use the medical profession. But know that it's only because it's given your alternatives. Not to go in with that trusting heart and the feeling that, well, if the doctor says so, it's got to be right, and who am I to criticize because I know less, and so forth and so on. You can come to a point where you can see inconsistencies. And anybody can see that. You don't have to be a great doctor to see that. And you can certainly ask for explanations, and you can read up on the material. My friend, who tended his wife for 2 years, caught so many mistakes. And just because he read the material, and he tended her, and he was with her, and he saw it. Yeah.
So that's the idea by when they choose to seek out a rabbi before they undergo any operations or different things. And
that certainly is true, in addition to medicine. Of course, you should use medicine, but also to go to a rabbi, especially a rabbi who has experience with medicine, like my Rebbe, who has been doing this for 45 years, 50 years, and has thousands and thousands and thousands of cases, because it's a counterbalance to the weaknesses of the profession. Quite right.
It's with the
That's right. That's right. We have a fellow in Baltimore. His mother lost 9 pregnancies. So they went to the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish said, "You'll become pregnant again. Go into Johns Hopkins Hospital. Go to so-and-so," he knew a doctor there somehow, "and tell him, I told you that you need to be in bed for the whole pregnancy. Get checked into the hospital and be in bed for the whole pregnancy, and you'll give birth to a son, and you should name him Shimon." And that's what happened. They went to the hospital. The hospital agreed to take her in. He's the author of a whole series of books on Nachla Shimon. I forget his last name, but he lives in Baltimore to this day. He's well known there. And they told me that after he was born, every 6 months they went back to the hospital because they wanted to check a person who had been born this way. They had never had a clinical case like that before, and they wanted to see what it would do to his development. His mother wasn't active during the whole pregnancy, but it turned out to be fine. And she didn't have any children thereafter. Like, oh, figure that. You know, what did he do? Flip coins? Did he give 4,000 advices to his people and we've forgotten all the 3,909 other ones and only this one is remembered because only this one worked? Baloney. Okay.